It is 6 minutes past the hour. Full disclosure, we have a great guest and a really important topic. So how can we miss? I'm a huge fan of Jennifer Joyner. Jennifer Joyner is a nurse practitioner in cardiology. She is the coordinator of structural heart disease program at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. And this is Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents Jennifer Joyner. We're going to have this important discussion about heart valve disease. And I just want to tell you a little bit about Jennifer to begin the program. Certifications, adult gerontology, primary care nurse practitioner, critical care nurse, cardiac surgery subspecialty, postmaster's certificate, advanced practice, nursing adult gerontology, primary care nurse practitioner, Monmouth University, West Long Branch, New Jersey, master of science in nursing, nursing education, Monmouth University, West Long Branch, New Jersey, bachelor of science in nursing, James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and special interests include structural heart disease, which makes a whole lot of sense with what we're going to be talking about here this half hour on Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents. Nurse Dad, Harry, and our distinguished expert, Jennifer. Jennifer, welcome to your program.
Thank you, Harry. I'm really excited to be here this morning.
Great to have you. Let's get right into it. What is heart valve disease?
Well, let's take a trip down anatomical lane for a minute. So I like to think of the heart as a house. It has four rooms. You've got top and bottom, left and right. We've got an electrical system that runs the impulses that make our heart kind of pump blood and contract. We've got a plumbing system, which is the arteries that feed the heart with blood and oxygen. And we've got doors. We have four one-way doors in between these rooms that help the blood go in one direction. These are the valves, and this is what we're here to talk about this morning. So these valves should be one-way valves, open wide and close shut. But sometimes they don't. Sometimes they don't open well. Sometimes they don't close well. And that's what we're dealing with in valve disease.
And correct me if I'm wrong, and I probably should just ask it as a proactive question and not take a chance on being wrong, but there's not just one type of heart valve disease. There are types of heart valve disease, correct?
That is correct. So when you have tight valves, we refer to them as stenosis. So the four valves of the heart. On the left side, we have the aortic valve and the mitral valve. They are the most commonly affected valves. And we have on the right side the tricuspid valve and the pulmonic valve. So if you have a tight aortic valve, we call that aortic stenosis. Mitral stenosis would be a tight mitral valve. If you've got leaky valves, valves that don't close properly, we call that regurgitation or insufficiency. So leaky mitral valve is mitral regurgitation, tricuspid regurgitation. So there's different reasons for leaky or stiff tight valves, but we have four valves and I guess eight problems.
Very interesting. And we're going to cover a lot over the course of the time we have with Jennifer on the topic of heart valve disease. How common is this? I know someone that might be listening to the program right now that needed heart valve replacement because of something, you know, that was determined. How common is heart valve disease?
Well, you know, as we all know, heart disease in general is still the number one killer in the United States. With valve disease, more than 5 million Americans are diagnosed with a heart valve problem each year. Most commonly in those over 65, they say that one in 40 adults over 65 has valve problems. Wow. And we all know one in 40 people. Like I said before, the mitral and the aortic valves are more commonly affected. The sad part is that valve disease is underdiagnosed, and even worse, it's undertreated. We tend to see them when they have advanced valve disease, and I really wish we could get them in sooner.
Jennifer, a wild card question. With people with valve issues, if maybe mitral valve prolapse or different things that people listening have heard the jargon and know people that have that. I know several people that have close to me, actually very, very close, that have mitral valve prolapse. So for example, if they're going to have like a dental procedure or anything involving something like that, they, unless this regimen has changed, I haven't checked it lately, they would go on a course of antibiotics beforehand. So this is nothing. If you're at a stage where you're not talking about valve replacement, but you're talking about that you're dealing with a valve issue, it's no joke, is it?
No, it's no joke at all. And early screening, early prevention, managing other health conditions that can either prevent or delay the progression of your valve disease or complicate it is really important.
What are the symptoms? Somebody listening right now that's just taking all this in, listening to the great Jennifer Joyner talk about heart valve disease, what are the symptoms?
Well, some symptoms can be vague at first. And, you know, many people chalk it up to the normal process of aging. So by the time we get to see them, sometimes they've had these symptoms for 6 months or longer. So these can include shortness of breath, particularly with exertion. You know, maybe you're noticing that you're kind of out of breath when you're dragging the trash out, or you're going upstairs and making the beds, or walking up inclines. You know, this isn't a normal process of aging. Maybe just doing your normal activities is tiring you out. You're getting exertional fatigue. Some people get swelling in their ankles and feet and lower legs. Some people have palpitations, dizziness, passing out or nearly passing out, chest pain, or even some fullness of the abdominal area. So, you know, I get it. We're getting older, we're busy, we're tired, we're stressed out. I know many of your listeners are babysitting for their grandchildren or caring for their ultra elderly parents or both. But these symptoms, while vague and could be explained or attributed or rationalized to other things in our life, they really should be looked at and, you know, get in to see your doctor for some screening. It could be something that's fixable.
Jennifer, one of your listeners just texted in while you were speaking about it in real time. That's why I love the digital component of our program. They said that does a cardiac catheterization, if you have that done, would that show that people hear about that and they think about blockages and things like that, you know, venous blockages and stuff. Would that pick up any type of valve issue?
You know, it can. It's not the primary purpose of the catheterization. Like we said, it's more looking at the plumbing or the arteries of the heart, but it can pick up some valve disease. But the best way to pick up the valve disease and really fully assess it is through a non-invasive echocardiogram. Echocardiogram takes about 45 minutes. It uses conduction jelly on the chest to produce the images and sound waves that the physicians need to evaluate all kinds of things of the heart, but including the valves.
Jennifer Joyner on this important topic on Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents. You can schedule an appointment by calling 609-621-2080. And I can also tell you that digitally from any smartphone or digital device, laptop, desktop, you know, iPad, whatever, demanddeborah.org, and you will see the big speed block hyperlink directly to scheduling an appointment. So either way, 609-621-2080 or demanddeborah.org. You're listening to Jennifer Joyner on the topic of heart valve disease. This obviously is of interest to many listening to the topic. Who is at risk for heart valve disease?
Well, there are different reasons for these different valve problems. Number one, some people are born with valve problems or abnormalities of the valves, and sometimes it needs to be addressed as an infant or as a young child, but sometimes these birth defects don't present themselves until you're older. For instance, the aortic valve, you should be born with three leaflets to the valve, but some people are born with two leaflets, and that's called bicuspid aortic valve. Or you have three, but two of them are fused and are acting like two. Well, this condition, you may not know about it until you're older, and that valve tends to wear out sooner than a typical three-leaflet valve. So if someone is between the age of 50 and 70, and they're coming in with valve-related symptoms, I'm going to be looking to see if they have a two-leaflet valve instead of a three, and that would explain why they're coming in typically 10, 15, 20 years sooner than the average patient with aortic stenosis.
We are going to take our one and only break right here, right now, and then we'll be uninterrupted the rest of the way. Jennifer Joyner is our guest. Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents Jennifer Joyner. And our discussion, the topic this half hour on Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents, is heart valve disease. When we come back, we're going to talk about, or I should say, I'm being generous, Jennifer is going to talk about, I will just pose the question, how is heart valve disease different from heart disease itself? Obviously a very important and definitive question. With Jennifer, I am.
Early in the morning, WPG Talk Radio 95.5 FM and 1450 AM.
Thank you. We're back. Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents Jennifer Joyner. Our discussion is heart valve disease, the topic, and we primed the question right before the break. I'll recast it now for Jennifer. How is heart valve disease, Jennifer, different from heart disease?
Harry, heart disease is kind of the big blanket umbrella term that we tend to describe lots of different types of heart problems, and valve disease is just one of them. But to get back to your previous question before the break, as far as who's at risk for valve disease, aside from people who are born with some valve problems, you know, you had mentioned mitral valve prolapse, and this is very common among women to live with. And it's not necessarily something that you have to worry about in and of itself. However, when you get older and other types of risk factors come into play with, you know, weight gain and uncontrolled blood pressure and diet and, you know, smoking and diabetes and all that, mitral valve prolapse can then kind of complicate the overall picture and contribute to worse leaking down the line. Mitral valve prolapse is kind of a kink in one of the valve leaflets. It has a very distinct slapping sound to it when you listen with a stethoscope. But in and of itself, it's very common, and most people can live with it without issue during their life. Infection is another risk factor. Rheumatic fever, thankfully, is not as common in the U.S. anymore, thanks to the discovery of penicillin, but it does still happen, and it is still fairly common in developing countries such as Central and South America, and we certainly have many people coming from Central and South America here. Yeah. So it impacts the valve tissue and tends to cause problems later in life. Endocarditis is a medical term used to describe infection of the valve leaflets themselves, typically from dental infections or IV drug abuse. It's very rare, but it is potentially devastating, and it's very hard to treat. So please get out there, see your dentist, do those regular checkups, because it is important and can contribute directly to valve disease. And of course, anyone with other types of heart disease, such as blocked arteries, heart attacks, heart failure, electrical conduction issues, long-term uncontrolled blood pressure, all of these things are connected and can contribute to or be a result of valve disease. It's almost like what comes first, the chicken or the egg. It's all related.
Jennifer, is that protocol where, I recall it because there's a family member that I know has mitral valve prolapse. And it's funny, I know two family members that do, and they are both female. But I had never heard before that it's mostly female. But there's two right there. 100% of the known ones in my family are both female. It's not like 200, but it's two. And they're both female. In terms of what they used to do, I remember whenever there would be like any type of procedure, dental procedure or anything, they would take an antibiotic for like a week beforehand. And I know things change over time, but is that still done, or is that something that used to be done?
You know, that was part of the old guidelines. Current guidelines do not recommend that people with mitral valve prolapse take an antibiotic prior to dental work, but that was a thing in the past. And I know that historically, if people have been doing it, they continue to do it, but it's not part of the current recommendations.
Jennifer, is that part of the, because antibiotics had been overprescribed and these drug resistant types of, you know, things that are happening now, it just was determined it's not really needed, so let's not do it, even though we used to do it, kind of thing?
That's correct. That's correct. The highest group of people that are at risk for that infection of the valves are people who have had tissue valve replacements before, people who have had heart transplants, people who have had previous dental infections causing endocarditis. These are your higher risk patients that absolutely should continue to use antibiotics about an hour before their dental appointment.
And Jennifer, I don't want to torture the heart valve disease, different from heart disease question too much, but I want to ask a question because I'm curious about it. And maybe some of our listeners are as well. You could have valve disease. Hypothetically, I'm submitting to you, Jennifer. Can you have valve disease, but have a heart muscle that is not damaged? Now, of course, if the valve disease progressed and then led to progression of things, you know, this could be a different answer, but you could have valve disease and not have a damaged heart at the same time, correct?
That is absolutely correct, especially if you pick it up early. You know, your provider, nurse practitioner, physician assistant, or family physician can often hear your valve problem with their stethoscope long before you even start feeling symptoms from it. And some of these valve conditions can take upwards of 10 years to become severe and significant.
Real strong reason why everyone should have that annual physical done. That's picked up by every health plan with not even a copay, because then you can pick up things like this.
Absolutely. If there are two points that I'd love for your listeners to take home today, it is number one, please get connected with a primary care physician. I think we overuse the urgent care system for chronic medical conditions in this country nowadays.
Agreed.
We go when we're sick. We don't go when we're healthy. And screening, number two, screening saves lives. Mm. The earlier you pick it up, the earlier you can manage, prevent, or delay progression of significant disease. So primary care physicians, so that they're the ones holding the bag, getting you to get your early screenings and vaccinations and everything else they think you need, and coordinating your care. But screening will save lives.
See, I think it's so important what you just said, both points. And I think it's also really important that your healthcare provider see you when you're well. If they only see you when you're unwell, this, you know, baseline and these things you hear that you can learn, then you learn the difference between, hey, I know what you're usually like, and this isn't that. So if you only see someone when they're unwell, I think that's not the way to go. So I could not agree more, Jennifer, with you. In terms of heart valve disease, and I know you talked about you gave part of the answer with mentioning that when you listen, you can pick it up at times. That could be one of the ways that it's diagnosed. How is heart valve disease diagnosed?
So it does start with your physical exam and listening to your symptoms. You know, we're very astute at picking up subtle symptoms from patients, you know, their history, their stories, what they've been doing, what's their quality of life, what do they like to do that they can't do anymore. The physical exam can pick up some valve problems. Believe it or not, I know a lot of people don't know this, but the sounds that you hear in the heart, ba-boom, ba-boom, it's not the heart beating, it's the sound of the valves. And each of the valves have a distinct sound when they're leaky or tight. So we can pick that up. We're not magicians. There's actual science to this. But that, coupled with the patient's history and how they're feeling, can then lead us to an echo. The echo will pick up the valve issues of the heart. And from there, the provider can start talking to the patients about other risk factors that they could work on. We're not talking about genetics. We're talking about, you know, weight management and diet and exercise and diabetes, all the things we always try to hammer home to people, but they really do make a difference in a lot of these valve conditions to either prevent or delay the progression of needing a valve repair or replacement down the road.
Jennifer, I'm telling you, you just knocked people over with a feather, and I'm one of them. I have been the host of the Deborah Heart and Lung Center television program and radio program for more than 31 years. I thought that we heard a heartbeat. You just knocked me over with the fact that we're not hearing the beating heart. You know, I don't know if you've ever picked up on this. I think you have. If you watch some of these reality TV shows, I've seen it even on shows like Big Brother and the other ones. They'll hug each other when they're leaving the house if they get voted out. So they're jazzed up, you know, their heart rate's going. You hear through their mics that they're wearing, they're mic'd up. You hear boom, 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 boom. Their heartbeat is going crazy. It's like 100 and some beats a minute. It's not 60 to 100. It's going bananas. I always thought that whenever a doctor or healthcare provider was listening, they hear a heartbeat. I never heard that before, that you're hearing the sound that the valves make. That's amazing to learn that.
Yeah, yeah.
Never knew it. So that's not the heartbeat that we're hearing. That's just such good knowledge to have. What are the treatment options?
So it depends on the type of problem you have. But if we can pick it up early with a stethoscope, generally you have no idea anything's going on. You're working, you're traveling, you're doing everything you want to do. But we hear that there's an abnormality. So at this point, we work with you to manage your lifestyle habits that could help prevent that progression. But as the disease progresses, we'd like to see you at least annually for a physical exam to listen to how your symptoms are and how your quality of life is. Maybe do an echo once a year to check on the specific valve's progression. But as the disease progresses and you start to develop the symptoms that we had talked about earlier, we may want to see you more often, every 6 months or even more often. Yeah. And then as you develop these symptoms, we may start medications such as water pills, such as blood pressure medications or other advanced heart failure medications to help control the symptoms and potentially, depending on your valve issue, slow down or prevent the progression. We're still going to be encouraging you to make those differences in the lifestyle choices because they do make a difference at every age. But at some point, you may need to be referred to a specialist for further evaluation of, is it time to repair or replace the valves. Now, keep in mind, this process from start to finish could take 10 years. It could take 2 years until you're referred for this discussion of valve replacement or repair, depending on how early the condition was picked up and how well it's been managed along with your other medical conditions. So traditionally, open heart surgery was your only option to repair or replace valves. And even in elderly patients, I worked with them for many years, they did okay for the most part, but it took a lot longer. And of course, there were some expected bumps along the way. But over the past decade or so, it's so exciting. The field is called structural heart disease, and less invasive ways of repairing and replacing valves have been developed. So instead of having to cut open your chest and have a 6 to 8 week recovery, we can use small puncture sites in the groin area and snake our equipment up from the inside, get into the heart, repair or replace valves in under an hour.
Wow.
And typically, you go home the next day with a Band-Aid to the puncture site for your troubles.
Final,
it's not for everyone.
Yes. Final minute.
You have to meet criteria.
Go ahead. Go ahead. I was just going to say, go ahead, Jennifer. Go ahead.
it's not for everyone. I mean, you do have to meet certain criteria, but more and more often people are being able to, and they are choosing the less invasive route, and it's exciting.
Yeah, I would think most people, if you told someone you can do something less invasive, you know, I can't imagine too many people would be, oh no, I want to do something that's more. So that's fantastic to hear. Final minute, and I really, you could tell jazzed up I was, I really wanted to get this in. How do you decide whether the pig valve is the best option, synthetic valve or whatever? How do you decide best option for the patient?
Well, in the open heart world, they have the choice of a metal valve where the leaflets of the valve are metal or tissue valves. And I can't speak too much as to why the surgeon would choose a pig tissue or a cow tissue valve. But in the less invasive world in which I work, we use a CAT scan, a special CAT scan with some IV contrast to light up and create a beautiful three-dimensional anatomical roadmap of what you look like on the inside from the groin up to the heart. And it tells us with the way your heart's anatomy is, because everyone's a little different, whether a cow tissue valve or a pig tissue valve would be best suited for your anatomy.
There
we like them both. We use them both, but the CAT scan will give us a better direction as to which one would be more suitable for your particular anatomy.
What's the life expectancy for the valve replacement? I don't mean how many years do you live after. How long is the valve good for?
You know, it's a great question, and we're continuing to investigate that with research. But, you know, we'd like to say that these less invasive valves can last 10 and more years. We don't know. They've been used in Europe a lot longer than they have in the U.S., so we can only quote U.S. data. But the data on younger and healthier patients is pretty solid, you know, at this point. So we're excited.
Jennifer Joyner, your presentation is the reason why people should go to Deborah Heart and Lung Center for heart valve disease treatment. You can call 609-621-2080 or visit demanddeborah.org. Jennifer, a privilege to present you today. What a wonderful presentation you made. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's my honor to be here.
My honor to present you. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Don't go away. This is
Early in the Morning.